Let's kind of conversation between the soul. Let's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And I am extremely excited about welcoming our guest today, John Orloff. John is the co-executive producer and lead writer of Masters of the Air, among many other things, but that's what we've invited him to talk about. So, John, thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So before we get into Masters of the Air, which we'll spend a lot of time talking about, I just want to ask you how you got into television writing, how you got into the industry. And in particular, just to be honest, like Band of Brothers was a very formative show for me. It's one of the reasons why I became a historian. It's one of the reasons why I study World War II. But beyond that, in particular, your two episodes, correct me if I'm wrong, Day of Days and Why We Fight, crucial for basically establishing the visual language of air war for like a generation of millennials. I'm sure you know, but the Day of Days sequence of the parachute entry into Normandy has like just basically been copied by a million video games and a million other things. So it's just like crucial. So could you just tell us how you got into the industry? And I'd love to hear anything you'd like to say about Band of Brothers as well.
Sure. I mean, and it's totally related to Masters. So I got into the business. I'm fourth generation Hollywood. My great grandparents were a radio comedy team called Fibber McGee and Molly. And they were big in radio in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And my father was a director, my grandfather was a director, and my grandmother was a B-movie actress. So I sort of grew up in the business as a kid and always wanted to be a filmmaker. I thought I wanted to be a director. Turns out, I don't know, I guess I'm just not built that way. And I wrote a spec script in my 20s. I went to UCLA Film School. Wrote a spec script in my late 20s about the Shakespeare authorship question. Nobody wanted to buy it. It was right when Shakespeare in Love came out, but it got me a meeting with Tom Hanks. He wanted to meet the guy who wrote that script. So I met with Tom Hanks, I'd say 1999, 98 maybe, and I knew he was working on this thing called Band of Brothers. I am a huge history buff, a huge World War II nut, a huge World War II movie nut. And so anytime I met with Tom in that like 4 or 5 month period, I would say, do you need any writers for Band of Brothers? And he'd go, no, we're just going to have one writer the whole show. Just one guy's going to write the whole thing. And finally, just in one meeting, he goes, you still want to work on Band of Brothers? And I'm like, yes. And he goes, great. You want to write the D-Day episode? Okay. And it was a pretty amazing, you know, moment. It was my first paying gig as a screenwriter. And I was writing the D-Day episode of Band of Brothers for Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg 2 years after Saving Private Ryan came, you know, out, which revolutionized filmmaking about warfare. And suddenly I was tasked with the job of trying to compete with the best 12 minutes or 20 minutes of filmmaking in forever. And that's how I got onto Band and became, I guess, a professional screenwriter. And then after I finished the second one, Tom and Steven had very little notes. And Tom just sort of said, hey, you want to write the concentration camp episode next? And I said, yes. And then suddenly I was writing kind of the Schindler's List. I had the Schindler's List problem after having the Saving Private Ryan problem. But that's how I got into the business, and that's how I got onto Band.
Well, John, you'll be surprised, happy to learn that you're talking to a veteran of the Band of Brothers HBO message board, where I think I talked with Bruce McKenna.
Yeah, Bruce and I were both really active. We were the youngest of the Band of Writers. We actually called ourselves the Band of Writers. And our not logo, but our saying is, did you serve in a company of hack writers? No, no, whatever the line is on did I serve in a company of heroes or whatever Winter says we did with hack writers. But we were really active, the young kids.
And I remember he talked to me. I'm like, I'm going to become a historian. He's like, great, you know, that's awesome. But I do want to talk for a second about Day of Days, because I think it does relate to Masters of the Air very directly, because it's about depicting air war and an extraordinarily influential depiction. So how did you approach that sort of moment of paratroop descent, which as far as I know, I was very young at the time. I had never really seen that form of D-Day depicted on screen. I'm sure it has been in the panoply of World War II films, but obviously Saving Private Ryan was, I remember seeing it with a bunch of World War II veterans, everyone in the theater was crying. But how did you approach that problem of the depiction of air war? I'd just love to hear about that.
Well, I didn't see it as a problem. You know, I saw it as a feature. You know, these guys got into airplanes, you know, and jumped out at, I can't remember anymore how high they were, a couple thousand feet, I think. I can't remember. And if that's not, this is what I always say about episode two, which, by the way, beat for beat in the script, everything you see in the action sequence. And that will be a great transition to Masters, because I took that same discipline of research into Masters. But I always like to say that if you have a story that contains a man who jumps out of an airplane into occupied Nazi France in the middle of the night, and he lands with nothing but a trench knife, and by the end of the day, he has stormed and taken four cannon that are shooting on Utah Beach. Now, if you can't make that interesting, then we're in the wrong business, right? And so for that episode in particular, it was just get out of the way. And that included that experience in planes themselves, the C-47s. Interestingly, that was the only note I really had from Tom, because in those planes on the way over, they were really nervous. And they actually sang songs to each other during the trip over the channel. And I had that in the original script. In fact, I think it was Gory Gory, What a Hell of a Way to Die. And Tom had me take that out, and he was totally right. You know, we needed to see their anxiety, their inner thoughts, and all of that.
It really is remarkable. Watching that episode and then watching Masters of the Air and the way you depict this stuff, I think in the modern conception, you think about all these guys are safe in their airplanes up there, but you watch these scenes and you come away thinking, like, how did any of them survive? Like, how did any between the flak and the German fighters, and just like how did anybody live through that? It's really remarkable.
Well, completely, and equally in Band of Brothers in the air, because that's when they lose Lieutenant Meehan, and they lose 20 guys in that, and their command structure basically goes down on one plane. Who knows how different Easy Company's experience would have been if Meehan lived? Anyway. By the time we're in Masters of the Air and now these guys are in these planes and the objective is to stay in the plane, right? as opposed to the objective of the paratroopers. Now that the objective is to stay in the plane and finish a mission, it's a whole nother ball of wax, and those planes have to protect them for a significantly longer time. Some of these missions are eight hours long, 9 hours long, as opposed to the trip over the channel, and they're only in combat on D-Day, you know, for, I don't know, 45 minutes or something. Here, they're in combat for hours and hours and hours, and there is absolutely right, no protection whatsoever. There's no armor in these planes because it would weigh them down, and it is negative 40 below zero. One of the things we don't spend enough time on in the show is the cold. Everybody just says how frickin' cold
it was
up there.
They had frozen piss on their legs for hours. It was
exactly.
Horrible. Yeah.
It was horrible.
I write about air war too. It was horrible.
Yeah. I mean, if I could do one, you know, you always can change things after the fact, but I wish we had more of the cold in there. And then, of course, it's an unpressurized cabin, so they have to have oxygen the whole time. And then there are these giant cannons shooting at you. And then these fucking airplanes arrive and start trying to kill you with rockets and cannon and machine guns. You know, I mean, it must have been terrifying. And like you see in the show, the 100th Bomber Group arrived with, I think it's 36 bombers in June of 43. And by the Munster mission that we see in episode 5, where he's the only plane to make it home out of 13. That is the mission where the total count is now 34 of those original 36 ships have been shot down. When I was talking to Tom really early on and we were talking about how do we deal with the casualties and characters, how do we get to know characters, dealing with all of that, I had to remind him there's one mission that we just saw last week, the first Berlin mission, March 6th, 1944, Bloody Monday, whatever it's called. They lost 15 B-17s with 150 men. And I was like, Tom, that is all of Easy Company, every single guy in one mission, gone. You know, that's the scale of the air war.
So, and it reminds you why Catch-22 is about air war. Because the having to go up there again and
it's
again and again.
It's a different experience. It's a whole different experience.
Right. And it's difficult to film. So that to me might be like, how did you, the anxiety of like you come down and you know you're going to have to do it again. And then as you, I loved in the last episode, they start raising the missions.
Yeah.
So like these guys, like, how did you approach that issue of portraying that anxiety about having to do it again and again?
Well,
and
it was key. It's one of the things that I think drew us all to the story because, you know, there was no reason to make Band of Brothers 2 or the Pacific 2 or Band of Brothers in the Air or the Pacific in the Air because all of these theaters of war are very different in texture and in fighting style and strategies and everything is different. And one of the things that really makes the air war unique is this weird snap going back and forth from utter terror to getting a drink and getting laid, you know, that night. You know, you can come home from a mission in Berlin and go to town and meet a girl and have a great time. You know, obviously in Band of Brothers, you're in theater for 6 weeks. You know, then you get to go home for a couple weeks. Then you're back in theater for 6 weeks. Here, the theater was 8 hours of harrowing, terrifying situations where the odds were really against you getting back that night. And so, yeah, you partied, you know, and then you had to get back in. And it was the getting back into the plane that obviously we all found interesting. And how different guys use different ways to do that. And also in different periods of the war, you know, Bucky Egan, John Egan has no problem getting back in that plane to go on the Munster mission that he eventually gets shot down in. Quite the opposite. He can't wait to get in the plane. And that is accurate. That is historically accurate. We should talk about the Munster mission and that mission. That mission was a really special mission because it was the first mission that the American Bomber Command had decided to target the inner city of a city, knowing that civilians would be casualties. Prior to that, October 8th, 1943, all of our targets were totally away from civilians. They were submarine pens on the ocean. They were factories outside of the city. The first time they're actually bombing the center of a city and they know civilians are going to be. And Egan, because he was about to avenge, he didn't know whether Buck Clevin's alive or dead. He started clapping and was roaring, bigger than we showed in the show. He was all in on that mission. So he had no problem getting into the plane. But after that mission, right, and he goes down, and now Rosie has just lived through one of the other things that I don't regret, but there was no way around it, was Rosie has had an incredible three fucking days. So the mission that Buck goes down on is the Bremen mission of October 8th. And they have, I think, like, these numbers are not going to be exact, but roughly 25 planes go up. Roughly 9 or 10 get shot down, including Clevin. That's why they only have 13 planes to go up 3 days later. And then 12 of those 13 planes are shot down. But Rosie went on all three of those. So there was a mission on, I think it was like Saturday, where they lose 10 planes that Rosie is on. Then they had a milk run on Sunday and they don't lose any planes. And then that Monday, they lose 12 planes. Those are his first three missions.
Unimaginable. It's unimaginable.
Yeah, so then he goes into the flak house. That's all true. And he comes back and he said, that was the hardest moment of the war for him, was getting back into the cockpit on that particular mission. You know, and I don't know how he did it. And I don't know if I would have.
So a couple of quick questions, because obviously I'm Jewish. And so I'm interested in the Jewish American characters, whether it's Liebgott or Rosie. So I'm just curious. How did, even though Liebgott turns out wasn't Jewish.
I know. But can I talk about that for a second?
Yeah, could you? I've always curious about
that. It's a really interesting thing about Band. You have to remember we wrote Band in 99 and shot it in 2000. But think about where the internet was in 1999. Basically, I mean, barely existed. And so we had to trust the guys. So like if you had a question, you'd call up a 78-year-old Dick Winters and you'd say, you know, Dick, tell me about like, you know, this and this. And they would tell you what they thought. You know, everybody thought Liebgott was Jewish. So they told me Liebgott was Jewish, you know. Similarly with Blythe dying. You know, the famous error of Band of Brothers is that Blythe, the main character of episode 3, we say in the afterword that he died of his wounds. He didn't die of his wounds. He actually fought in Korea and won medals. And, you know, but we just didn't know because all the guys thought he died.
And I mean, in some form of social death, right? I mean, there's a truth there, even if not like literally he didn't die. I think, I mean, and that's dramatic storytelling. And I was just curious, how did you approach the Rosie? I mean, his life is insane.
He becomes
a Nuremberg prosecutor. He was a lawyer in Nuremberg and he fights in Korea. I mean, I had actually heard of him beforehand through some like Jewish American thing, but I'm curious, like, it's implied in the show, but I was wondering how you decided to deal with his literal Jewishness.
Have you watched the whole thing? Did you guys watch?
Yeah. Oh, I didn't see the whole. No, I haven't seen the whole series.
Okay, so episode 9, we get a little more into it because of a real event that happened to him in episode 9. Apple is really clear. I'm not good with the spoilers. I can't talk about the spoilers.
Totally, we won't. No, that's absolutely fine.
But there's an explicit beat or two in episode 9. I mean, the thing that's interesting about Rosie was, while he was very much Jewish, he was also a humanist. And
all those generations of Jews were.
I think they genuinely were.
It makes sense. It's a response to anti-Semitism.
He was not going over there to save Jewry, you know, European Jews. He was going over there to rescue the people who couldn't fight for themselves, Jewish or otherwise. He had a real deep thinking about that. And in fact, after the war, he wouldn't accept the English Distinguished Flying Cross because of Palestine. I mean, he has a very complicated, not complicated, but yes, his Jewish identity is really important to him, and it's not.
Right. Like, it's a very, very similar experience of a lot of Jews of that generation.
Right, at that time, especially semi-intellectual.
Yeah, college-educated Jews who are secularizing, whose parents or grandparents fled Ukraine. My grandfather was a veteran of World War II.
Can I just say one thing? One of the things, Rosie is really, I think, for me, the main reason I wanted to do this show. I mean, Buck and Bucky have an amazing story, no question. But I think Rosie's just a whole nother level of amazing. Both just his story is amazing and what he accomplished is a lot more amazing to me than what Buck and Bucky did.
It could be a movie. I mean, take him into the 50s. Yeah. It's wild. Like, you could first three, World War II,
well,
then Nuremberg.
His son, I've made his son get a biographer to start working on a biography of him because there is none. You know, that was one of my challenges with the whole show, in fact, was when Hanks asked me to come on board about 10 years ago, he, you know, gave me the book Masters of the Air by Don Miller, which is a spectacular book. Don is a really great writer. I really recommend pretty much all of his books. But Masters of the Air is a history of the entire air war over Germany. It's not 100th Bomber Group specific, much less specific about the guys in the show. Yeah, those guys are mentioned. You know, and some of them, you know, 20, 30, 40 pages, but that's it. It's not their whole journey in this to, they were almost, I mean, the Hundreds there for 2 years, right? They arrive in June of 43. VE Day is June of 45. So they're there 2 years. And so my first task was basically writing a 250-page book about these four guys, Egan, Clevin, Rosie, and Crosby. I just fell in love with Rosie. I mean, his story is really amazing. And I like to say that, to me, Rosie is sort of the inverted amazing soldier to Dick Winters. They're very different as leaders and as human beings, and yet equally indispensable, it seems to me, in this all-out war. I mean, I always like to say that I consider myself a friend of Dick Winters in some way. We knew each other for a number of years pretty well. And I think he is appropriately named. If I were a novelist, Winters would not be a bad name to name that character. Equally, Rosie is a very good name for Robert Rosenthal. Just that's who he was. Happy. There's all these stories of, you know, tech sergeants walking up to Rosie and saluting him. And then Rosie just kind of, hey, how you doing? You know, you just kind of nod and wave to them. You know, he's just a nice, nice man who did the right thing.
It's Pennsylvania Protestantism versus New York City sort of Jewish ebullience, you know. But what's interesting about World War II is that they all come together in this sort of crucial moment. And I actually wanted to ask directly, what was your process for researching this? Did you have to go to the National Archives? Did you read a lot of materials? How did this work?
Sort of as an asterisk to our Band of Brothers conversation, it's now the polar opposite. So a lot of it was just online. You know, you can get the Air Force records, the Army Air Corps records. A lot of this is based on after mission reports, diaries of people. Red Bowman, who is the intelligence officer through the whole nine episodes, kind of redhead, he had a diary during the war, you know, that was very work specific. It wasn't very personal. It's very much about the missions. And so the guys were not alive, so that was really difficult. And it was deep. It was a full year. It took me a year before I had what we call a Bible, which is like, in my case, a 250-page document with 500 footnotes to 30 different sources. And the reason it was so voluminous was because, having worked on Band and knowing all the guys on the Pacific, I thought, well, let me try to figure out ways to help us ahead of time, you know? So that was just a tremendous amount of work, quite frankly, but I loved it. And I went to Thorpe Abbott's, which is where they're based. And then I had access. They have a great little museum there. I highly encourage people to go see it if you find yourself in East Anglia. Pictures, photographs, again, after mission reports. And I do want to sort of say, because it meant a lot to me, having made Band of Brothers and specifically Day of Days. And as I mentioned earlier, that's really accurate for Bray Corps Manor, as good as I can tell. I'm sure there, since then, people have figured out shit. But you know, I interviewed all the survivors in 99, and it is beat for beat the best I could do in a Rashomon fashion, because they didn't all agree with every little beat. I wanted to do the similar thing here in Masters of the Air. And we had the ability to do that because the after mission reports were so complete after these missions, because they were going so badly and they were trying desperately to figure out, how do we make the next mission not have 12 out of 13 planes go down? And so these after mission interrogations were really important, and those documents still exist. So that led me to the place where, in every single battle, if you see a plane go down, that's because that plane really went down. You know, it's not the third plane from the left because we need a beat of a plane going down so people are scared. No. The let's just take the Regensburg mission, which is episode 3. You know, everything in that mission is timed from the fact that Buck Clevin's ship, in reality, the Austin Butler plane, in reality, was hit 5 or 6 times by cannon and rocket fire. I mean, 5 or 6 times. That's a lot. Direct hits. That plane should have gone down. But anyway, that was the framework of the episode. So I then researched what happened to all the other planes. You know, 9 planes, I think, go down on that mission. We tracked all 9 of them. So when you see a plane hit and it gets hit because engine number 3 is on fire, more likely than not, that's what really happened. And I, the writer, certainly, and the director and then the effects guys, we know what the name of that plane was that went down, and we know everything.
And I'm sure that's true of the visual imagery as well, as when you see like a guy on fire get cleaved,
absolutely,
yeah, by a
absolutely
plane. Yeah.
So sometimes, you know, a director might go a little further.
These directors.
These directors. It didn't happen a ton, but, you know, it did. It did, actually. You know, that's okay. It is a collaborative medium, and sometimes they were right. You know, I mean, I'm not saying that they were wrong, or things would have to get moved. You know, Biddick's death. There's different versions of how Biddick died, and the version that we show is actually pretty close to one version of how he died. That he did go down, and he crashed, and in that version he crashed and avoided saving a little German village, and that is an official version. There is another official version where other guys in other planes said what really happened was there was an oxygen fire in the cockpit, and he and Snyder tried to get out of the cockpit fire by squeezing out of the windows in the cockpit. And they both die somehow there, with one of them, I think Snyder, getting cut in half by the rear tail, the stabilizing tail in the back. And so we decided that it was dramatically better to go with the other version because that gives Biddick a little bit more running room to be an actor and a hero, and that all works. But we still wanted to keep that brutality of men. When people talked about Regensburg, it was a 3D event. You know, it was, things were in the air. They didn't just, you know, there was cockpits and bodies and doors flying at you in the slipstream. There was a slipstream because all these planes, right? So they didn't just go down, you know, this shit. So anyway, and guys got hit by planes, you know, and we wanted to keep that brutality. So, you know, that's an example of, okay, well, it didn't necessarily happen on that plane at that second. But so every once in a while, we'll do something like that.
Yeah, and that was a very affecting scene, you know, when he realizes he's going to die and it's just like calm. I thought that was really,
yeah,
really
no, affecting. And I think it's actually a really great moment in the show of, Barry is a great actor, and just that moment where he says, oh God, you know, and he knows, you know, he managed to save it in episode 2. You know, it's a very similar situation to what he has in episode 2, and he pulled it off, but he can't pull it off in episode 3, you know.
American Prestige is brought to you in partnership with The Nation magazine. Please consider becoming a subscriber at americanprestigepod.com/subscribe. As a subscriber, you'll get access to dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, including breaking news specials, deep dives into regional histories, analysis of movies and video games, and much more. And if you subscribe at the founders level, you'll be able to claim a year digital subscription to The Nation. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
So one of the things that why I write and find air war interesting is that there's this idea in the 30s that this is going to make war more humane, that you're going to take out their, you know, ball bearing plants and their electrical plants, and then war is going to end. One of the reasons that the U.S. does daytime bombing, which is gestured toward in the show, where the British are much less concerned, though the U.S. does eventually, as you say, switch to basically, fuck it, we're going to bomb the hell out of Germany.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, like, given the role that this notion of humane war has played in American thinking about war since the end of the Cold War, in particular since in the 1990s and 2000s, that we're going to have war, but it's going to be less expensive, you'll have fewer casualties. And really, that notion comes from Air War, comes from Billy Mitchell, comes from these guys writing in the 20s and the 30s.
Curtis LeMay.
Yeah, Bombs Away LeMay. I just published an essay on LeMay on all of his post-war speeches in 1946, where he's trying to convince the Americans, oh, we got to keep this thing going. We need to be independent. Yeah. A lot of it's related to the Air Force being independent.
Oh, he was actually in the chain of command of the 100th Bomber Group and was a character in the show in very early days.
Yeah. And then he goes to the Pacific and he does the Tokyo bombing, like one of the most brutal bombings in human history, the firebombing of Tokyo. So I was just wondering, how did you approach this notion of strategic bombing and humane war and showing that subtle shift to the American command being like, we can't really do that. We're just going to have to bomb the hell out of them.
I chose not to. And what I mean by that is, yes, it exists and it's in the world of the show and you can search it out and talk about it if we want to find those moments that are relevant. And they are in there. And we'll talk about that in a second. But I think all of our very primary goal in making this show was trying to give you, the audience, as visceral an experience of the airmen themselves. And from their perspective, you know, always from their perspective. We never talk to senior officers. We never really explore, is this morally justified or not? We just show you the facts, ma'am, you know, and we show you the results of bombing on both sides and that civilians are killed on both sides. You'll see a little bit more references to it in episode 9, where we're a little bit more on the ground in Germany, not just the Stalag. This would not be a spoiler, but as the Russians were approaching the eastern side of the Reich, the Germans decided to get the POWs away from being rescued and marched them down to Munich. Not just our POWs, but basically the whole POW system of the Germans at that point, not for execution, but for possible hostages and negotiations and all of that. So these guys do a huge march along Germany, which was really interesting to me as a storyteller to sort of explore Germany as it is all coming down, you know. And we see some of the bombing results of Allied bombing in that experience.
Yeah, it always just struck me that someone like Howard Zinn makes his political turn because he was a bomber. You know, and he's
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Like he goes, I first became politically like awoken, you know, Jewish American from the same as Rosie. Very interesting. And he's just like, I couldn't like, he's like, we kind of had to bomb them, but did we? And so it's just
interesting.
I think.
And then obviously Vonnegut and Heller. And,
of course. Yeah. The air war is, I think, one of the most crucial moments, turning points in 20th century history. It sort of shoots off into a bunch of different ideological areas about how you interpret that war. I mean, one of the most interesting things to me is after they bomb Hiroshima, which is crucial for the air war, because now you're saying the Air Force has an independent strategic mission. I believe it was Norstad who wrote back, this was the most effective thing we've ever done. One bomb, we ended a war. You know, like it was super, super precise. Right. Even though it killed the city, right? So it's very interesting how this is thought about in the American imagination. But sorry, Derek, I know you had a question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you bring everybody into the story in the first few episodes through the stories of Buck Clevin and Bucky Egan. What were your, what attracted you to those two characters in particular and how you sort of portray them?
Well, first of all, the easiest answer to that is that's what started the show. Spielberg, Steven read Masters of the Air, I think before Tom did. And he, Steven, fell really in love with Buck and Bucky because they do have, it is a love story. Ultimately, as when the show is over, you're going to say, oh, it's a love story, but you know, between these two best friends. That's what the show is. And they get separated and get back together. They get separated, they get back together. More to come, by the way. And it's a great story. I mean, it is amazing on paper. These two guys meet in 1940 in cadet school. And so first, just to answer, so it was Spielberg's idea, right? So Spielberg reads the book. He says, this should be the heart of the next show. Have at it, Tom. Tom calls me. I read it and I say, well, let's add some Crosby in there because we need Crosby from a narrative standpoint, because you have the sort of first generation pilots of Buck and Bucky, and then you have the second generation of pilots with Rosie, because remember, they don't really intersect very much, you know? So because Buck and Bucky are shot down on Rosie's first and third missions, and he ends up flying a lot more than three. So, and as you just said, he's such a great character. You can't not do him, right? So the way that that all works is because Crosby is there the whole time from a narrative standpoint. But anyway.
Navigator is so crucial. Like when you read these books, the Navigator is so important to know and know about them. It's the whole thing, you know?
And there's no radar. There's no radar. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
No. I was just going to say, I just love that you focus on the navigator because it is so important. It's the whole thing. And they're never focused upon because they don't have a gun and they're not flying the plane.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really thrilled that they bought that idea, you know, that we focus on Kroz. But then when you actually read the story of Buck and Bucky, or you learn it, so they meet in 1940 and they are of the generation of pilots who join the Army Air Corps, not because they want to join the Army, but because they want to learn how to fly. You know, it's Test Pilot, the movie Test Pilot comes out in, I think, 38, maybe 39, I can't remember. It's Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable. It is the Top Gun and the Maverick of its time, times 20. And young men want to be like them. And they want to join up so they can fly airplanes. So they join up for romantic reasons, not to defend their country, but because they want to wear scarves and aviator glasses and get laid.
Yeah, the romance of flying is what its historians
call it.
It's
still a thing in 1940.
Big thing,
yeah,
huge.
It's a big thing. It's a romantic thing. And Lindbergh is one of the country's greatest heroes, just whatever his politics are and whatever he thinks about what's coming. And, you know, so they've joined up for these whole other reasons. They meet in cadet school. I think they bunk together in cadet school. Then the war starts. They end up in the same unit, the 100th Bomber Group. And they joined in spring of 40, 18 months before Pearl Harbor. And I don't actually know what they did for most of that 18 months. But then they are assigned to the 100th Bomber Group when we're starting to form these bombers. Now, the other thing that I think is really important to the show is we start the show, well, the war starts with America having 200 B-17s around the world. We ended up building 13,000 of them by 1945 and 18,000 B-24s. We start with an Air Force of 200 bombers, and we build 30,000 in 3 years. I mean,
using World War One engines, using Liberty engines, you know, it's wild.
It is actually one of the most amazing things about America and the war to me. So the 100th Bomber Group is formed up. They are now majors because they've been in the Army for so long. And now they're squadron commanders. And then they go off to war together. They get shut down within 3 days of each other. They end up at the same POW camp. And they do bunk together in Stalag Luft 3 for the end of the war. And then you're going to see some things in episode 9 that really happen that you're just going to go, wow. You know, it's an amazing story. In fact, one of the things that I've kind of taken umbrage of, you know, everybody has their opinions, but I've seen a lot of feedback with people just thinking these things are too Hollywood, you know, and well, no, they really happened. This stuff really happened. You know?
I always say that to people. It's that if you read these stories, they're more wild than what you could imagine. Like the Hans von Luck story about the Panzer commander, this guy's on every front, you know, every German front and survives. Right. The real stories are crazier than anything Hollywood could imagine. And
exactly.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. And a lot of my work is sort of threading the needle between those amazing stories and setting them up right and building the kit, you know. Because we want to keep those great moments in,
you know?
You've alluded to this a couple of times, but one of the things that struck me about the series is in terms of putting people in a different environment than, let's say, Band of Brothers or the Pacific, not yeah. only putting them in the environment of being in these B-17s and the minds of the bombers, but also it takes people into the POW experience. Can yeah. you talk a little bit about writing that part of it and what that entailed?
Yeah. It again, a lot of research. I got to know a few real hardcore POW historians and children of men who lived in the Stalags. Talked to a couple guys who were in them. You know, the Stalags are also really complicated and interesting and fascinating, and they could have been their own show. I mean, the hardest thing has in adapting the story has sort of been trying to figure out what not to show. There's so much that you can get into. You know, I for a time, a character was going to join the Luftbansters. You know, they had a band in the Stalag, and you know, the escapes were actually, for a certain time, the escapes were happening 2 times a week. People were trying to escape. We decided not to focus on that because you've seen that before. And mostly they never, ever, ever worked. But yeah, it was just more research and more research and discovering little things you'd never think about. I'm actually the person who discovered that Buck Cleven actually was a radio operator in the Stalag during his internment. He was brilliant. He already had graduated college by the time he joined up as an undergrad. And then after the war, he gets 2 postgraduate degrees, a doctorate in like astrophysics. And I mean, he's a really fucking smart dude. I found this just amongst all these papers, this thing where after the war, he was given like a little piece of paper that's gave him honors for being in the chicken coop, or I can't remember how they called it, but it was the code name for the radio room. And once I knew, oh, wait a minute, he was part of the X group was the people who were trying to figure out escapes and communications. I mean, I wish I could have gone deeper into that stuff because it's really fascinating. But you know, we just don't have enough time.
I mean, the production, it looks so good. What an amazing looking show.
The production, I was over there for the whole time, and pretty much everybody who worked on it just said, I've never seen anything like it. So our average day was around 1,200, 1,300 people. That was like a Monday, you know, and it's all in the middle of COVID. So they all have to be tested. A couple hundred of them were COVID people. Yeah, we're wearing masks the whole time. I mean, there were days where we had like 200 or 300 extras. I mean, just think of the logistics of trying to feed 200 or 300 extras, a crew of like 700, and all try to not have COVID.
Probably got them used to wearing masks, at least for those plane scenes. So yeah. One question that I have is that obviously the U.S. has a lot of foreign policy. That's what our show is about. Do you see your work as speaking to the present moment in any way, or is it mostly, are you interested in the verisimilitude of trying to show what it was like to be in war?
No, I definitely think about the present when I'm writing. And you know, I think for me, you know, when you're sitting down and you're writing, and a lot of what I was writing for much of the last decade, and because there's a lot of rewriting involved, has been men dying fighting fascism. Young American boys dying in the most awful, horrible ways imaginable in order to defeat bullies. And so I found it very difficult some days in the last several years or more than several years.
What could you be referring to?
I found it really difficult because, you know, coming back to what I said earlier, when you see a plane go down and there's 10 guys going down, well, I've already, I spent a day probably figuring out who those people were, what plane was it, how many survivors were there, do we see parachutes? You know, it's, to me, it's, those are CGI, but they're not CGI to me. Those are real men who died for the society, the NATO, the society that exists in a UN-NATO framework. You know, that's what they died for, was for the post-war. Now, I'm sure we can talk about how imperfect the post-war is. And
we'll leave that for another time.
We'll leave that for another time. But they set up a society. They tried very hard to set up a society in their wake that would not allow things that we are seeing return.
Yeah, I think they died for liberalism in a real way.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, as a historian, to compare. I don't think
small L.
Broadly American. I don't think many people would do that. So it's also an interesting, when ideal and belief had more of a resonance.
Well, I want to just put this out there and you guys can take it. I really believe that it is not a coincidence that we are seeing the rise of fascism at exactly the same time we're seeing the death of the last people who really dealt with it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, the institutional memory of why it's bad has been lost. You know,
I think that's absolutely the case. And it's also like people don't get how violent war is. There's no like real mass experience of war. World War II is really the last one. Vietnam is, obviously, many people died and fought, but it wasn't as mass as World War II. So it's a totally different.
It makes me, I see a lot of parallels, you know, to the 30s to now, you know, and I really hope that what occurred in World War II is not necessary in our future.
Absolutely. So just a final question. So obviously, is there going to be another one? We've got the Army, we've got the Marines, we've got the Air War. We don't have the Navy War on sea.
Well, we have Tom doing Greyhound.
Yes, probably
doing Greyhound 2.
It doesn't seem like there's going to be another like massive 10-parter.
So hard. It was took 10 years for fuck's sake, you know, these are really hard to make, you know, people don't understand. I mean, I think these are really hard to make, you know, they're incredibly expensive, but they're expensive not because anybody's making a fortune on them. They're expensive because it's just really hard to do. It takes thousands and thousands and thousands of people working unbelievable hours. And, there might, you never know. I think we're all just taking a breath right now. You know, this was a big hump.
John, thank you so much for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. And everyone, check out Masters of the Air.